There have been many studies comparing SSRIs, psychotropic drugs, and exercise for patients who are depressed. And it clearly is the best. No side effects, no decreased libido, no nausea, sleep, and all that stuff. So it's doing the right thing, and the unintended side effect is a healthier, more productive life.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Longevity by Design. I'm your host, Dr. Gil Blunder. In this episode, Ashley and I interviewed the longtime team neurosurgeon to the Pittsburgh Steelers, Dr. Joseph Maroon. Dr. Maroon discussed many topics related to neurosurgery, including his experience in the NFL, how concussion impact the brain, new concussion detection technology, why VO2 max is a great biomarker of fitness, and how triathlon saved his life. Dr. Maroon also shared the finding from his research. He recently published about how oxidative stress is the primary cause of Alzheimer's disease. He explained why sleep can help prevent Alzheimer's and give other lifestyle advice for how to promote brain health as we age. I thought this discussion was fascinating, and I hope you do too. If you enjoy Longevity by Design, support us by rating and reviewing the podcast. Thank you so much.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blunder joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Ashley Raver, and I'm joined by Dr. Gil Blunder. Welcome to Longevity by Design, How to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. We're produced by Inside Tracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Maroon. Dr. Maroon is a professor of neurosurgery at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, longtime team neurosurgeon to the Pittsburgh Steelers, and medical director of World Wrestling Entertainment. Dr. Maroon received his education at Indiana University, Georgetown, University of Vermont, and Oxford University in England. Academically, he has authored more than 300 scientific peer-reviewed papers, 7 books, and 60 book chapters. He is a senior vice president of the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. We're so thrilled to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Ashley. My pleasure.
Joe, it's a really pleasure having you. Especially that I'm following you and know you for more than a few years, I would say.
Certainly.
And, we are really excited to have you as an Inside Tracker user, also as an investor in the company. And as I said before the recording a few months ago, when I met with Dr. Shai Efrati, I heard the story about you, about your triathlon running, and I'm sure that we'll discuss it later. So it's a real pleasure to close the loop and interview you for our podcast. And we always start with a question about more about the motivation and why have you decided to become a clinician, a physician, and specifically a neurosurgeon?
Absolutely, Gil. It's a real pleasure to be with you and Ashton today as well. And you know, a very leading question in terms of why did I want to become a neurosurgeon? And I always was, and I remain fascinated by how within our intracranial compartment, we have 86 billion neurons, and each of those have up to 5,000 synaptic connections with over 100 trillion synaptic connections. And how the brain functions in terms of our feelings, our emotions, our creativity, and also how it's disrupted by various pathological processes, both structural as well as functional. Meaning, you know, for the last 50 years, Gil, it's hard to believe, I've been somewhat of a brain mechanic removing brain tumors and aneurysms and blood clots from trauma and repairing spinal fluid pathways. But there's a whole larger area of functional neurosurgery now that's actually just booming in terms of using various neuromodulation types of devices and energy sources to modulate the brain and behavior. So that's kind of a quick overview of my interests. And I'm still very, very much involved with research into both the structural and the functional aspect of brain behavior.
I heard before, too, that you didn't go to school for medicine. It was a fallback. Or if it didn't happen, you could become a lawyer.
I don't know where you got all this information, actually, but that's true. When I played football in high school. I grew up in Bridgeport, Ohio. About 3,500 people, 12 bars, and 35 dogs. And you had three options in Bridgeport, Ohio, on the Ohio River when you graduated from high school. You either went to the steel mills, the coal mines, or you got an athletic scholarship. And I was very fortunate to get an athletic scholarship to Indiana University for football. And neither of my parents, nobody in my family went to college before I did. So I really didn't have a very good perspective. And I really went to Indiana to play football. And I was put into a dormitory with a bunch of pre-meds. And they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, well, my father wants me to be an attorney, I think to keep him out of jail. And that's true. They said, how'd you do in biology? I said, I did pretty well in high school. And they said, well, let's sign you up for pre-med. You can always drop down to law if you don't like it. And I got on that train, and here we are today.
So you haven't dropped down to law. That's good. You stay. So Joe, we'd like to now go a bit into a science and the specifically about neuro-related diseases. If you can describe the landscape, what are the most common diseases and maybe what is the relationship for aging?
The most common diseases in neurosurgery, as contrasted with neurology, which is non-surgical. But in neurosurgery, traumatic brain injury, traumatic spinal cord injuries, probably the most common entity that we deal with. The other, however, is spinal cord injuries, quadriplegia, paraplegia, cervical spondylosis, arthritis of the spine, herniated discs. These are all entities that neurosurgeons devote a huge amount of time to, as well as the functional things, the vascular strokes, aneurysms, arteriovenous malformations, and then the whole new pediatric aspect of congenital diseases of the brain and spinal cord. So these are the neurosurgical structural problems that we deal with. The neurological problems in terms of aging, Gil, of course, Alzheimer's disease. 6.5 to 7 million people have Alzheimer's, and all 70, between those and 65 and 70, 1 out of 9 people will develop it, and over 80, 1 out of 3 or 4. So dementia is a huge, huge problem. And problems like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, multiple sclerosis that gradually destroys the various aspects of the brain and cerebellum. So neurodegenerative diseases. And I'm really very interested in this, and we can discuss some of the work I'm doing with the former director of the National Indian Brain Institute, using MR spectroscopy, looking at the brains of patients with Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. And we've recently, in the last few months, have published several papers showing that the pathogenesis of both of those diseases, including ALS, probably has its basis in oxidative stress. And actually, you're very familiar with that in terms of the free radicals that are generated with the manufacturing of ATP. And we've shown non-invasively that glutathione, the main antioxidant in the brain, is markedly deficient in PD and AD. And there's also a compensatory increase in iron in both of those entities, which we're speculating leads to possible therapeutic implications in terms of ways of increasing glutathione, maybe to slow or maybe even prevent the degradation and the neurodegeneration in both of those diseases. And also iron chelating agents that may be available, that are available, to reduce the iron load. So oxidative stress leads to mitochondrial damage, leads to an immune response in terms of the microglia, leads to the beta amyloid plaque, the neurofibrillary tangles. So we believe that we're not unique. It's been recognized for 10 to 20 years that oxidative stress is a main etiological factor in the precipitation of these diseases. We've just been able to show it now non-invasively for the first time, really, using MR spectroscopy.
Yeah, and if we are talking about that, what, in your opinion, are lifestyle intervention to decrease the oxidative stress?
Excellent question. How do we reduce oxidative stress? It gets into the five epigenetic factors that we have control over. Number one, diet. Number two, exercise. Number three, avoiding environmental toxins. Number four, controlling stress, which is very neurotoxic to the brain, particularly the hippocampus, where memory is subserved, and also getting enough sleep. These are all epigenetic factors above the genome that tells our 100,000 different proteins whether or not our genes to make anti-inflammatory or inflammatory agents. And as both of you so well know, inflammation is the common genesis of Alzheimer's disease, MS, heart attacks, strokes. So those are the things that every day we have a choice. It's a choice to make in how we control each of these epigenetic factors.
And can you go a little bit more detail about what environmental toxins are, ones that you mentioned?
Sure. You know, when we're talking about environmental toxins, we're smoking cigarettes, smoking any kind of combustible types of things, and particularly marijuana. You know, I know marijuana is now looked at kind of like alcohol. You just control it. There's no significant downsides. But in the teenage brain, it's a horrible problem, in my opinion. And when I say that, you understand the connectome, how the brain is wired. I mentioned 86 billion neurons with 100 million connections, all put together in fiber tracks that form the wiring diagram of the brain, the connectome. And the wiring in the insulation, around the axons and the fibers doesn't completely mature until we're 24, 25 years of age. So the kids who smoke marijuana, the mother who uses excess alcohol or drugs during pregnancy with the fetus in her womb, this all affects the wiring of the brain for the rest of the kid's life. So in the teenagers, do you realize, and this was a shock to me, that one out of four or five teenagers between 12 and 18 will be using marijuana 3 to 6 times a month. Think of that.
That's crazy.
This in high school, 25% of kids are smoking marijuana thinking, it's okay. And maybe my mom and dad do it for recreation, so it's even doubly okay. But what they're doing, they're affecting the wiring, the development, the synaptic connections in the axonal insulation around their neurons and networks, leading them to be potential addicts. It's a gateway thing. And also a higher incidence of schizophrenia, paranoia, and major psychiatric problems. But it's okay. It's legal. So why not do it? And I'm looking out my window right now at a high school across the way, thinking one out of four of those kids, 5 or 6 times this week, are going to be smoking marijuana.
Yeah. I visited in a few colleges in the last few years, and you go into the college and you smell it. It's like, it's like everyone is smoking there. It's not bad.
For adults, adults can handle it better.
Yeah.
But for the developing brain, it's a toxin.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that in a few years, similar to what happened now, even with alcohol right now, there is so much data that show that drinking too much alcohol, especially in the evening, can be very bad for you because of sleep. I think that we don't have enough data about marijuana yet. So it's something that, we don't know enough, and I agree with you. People need to be careful about it. Don't overuse it. Absolutely. Joe, I see on your share the logo of the Steelers, and we know that you spent a lot of time with them, and we know that football, let's say, they predispose to concussion, the football players. So maybe we'll start with explanation. What is concussion, if you can?
Sure. Yeah, I've been with the Steelers now for over 40 years, Gil.
You've seen a lot of events of concussion, I see.
I've seen a lot of concussions and a lot of different types of injuries, neurological and otherwise. And a concussion, the simple definition, it's a transient disturbance of neurological function by mechanical forces that results in a syndrome characterized by, in only 10% of the cases, loss of consciousness. 90% of concussions are not associated with the loss of consciousness, but it's associated with fogginess, which is the number one symptom of a concussion. I feel foggy. I'm having a headache. I have photophobia. The lights bother me. I can't process information as quickly as I could before. I have mood swings. These are all symptoms related with a concussion. And, you know, in the past, we thought you really didn't have a concussion unless you were knocked out, unconscious. But that only occurs in about 10% of patients with concussions. So that when I first got involved with the NFL and with the Steelers, the return to play criteria of an individual who came out having been hit in the head was holding up two fingers. And how many fingers do you see? If they said two, you can go back in. That's radically changed now, and it's changed. I like to take a little bit of credit for it. In 1990, 100 years ago, it seems, I told Coach Chuck Knoll, who is the head football coach of the Steelers, 4-time Super Bowl winner, that his starting quarterback couldn't play against the Dallas Cowboys the next week. And he said, why not? I said, because he's had a concussion and the guidelines say he has to stay out a minimum of 2 weeks. Well, he looks good to me. He knows his plays. He can run. He's not complaining of anything. Why not 3 weeks? Why not 1 week? And he said, Marone, if you want me to keep somebody out, I want objective data. not specious guidelines. And I thought, I know more about this than he does. What's a football coach telling me about concussions? But he was right. I thought about it and I went to Mark Lovell, a neuropsychologist, and I said, Mark, we need to come up with a test to assess whether or not an individual can go back. So we came up with a test called the impact test. And this is a neurocognitive test, initially paper and pen, now computer-based, which assesses one's ability to process information, memory, and recall, and also the ability to use abstract information. 20-minute test. Fast forward, we went back to Coach Knoll and said, we got to baseline the whole team. If you want objective data, we got to know what it's like before as well as after. Well, he and Dan Rooney, the owner at the time, gave us their imprimatur. We tested everybody. Fast forward, the National Hockey League accepted this for all players in the league in 1995. And in 2006, the NFL adopted it. And we now have baseline 23 million kids and athletes with this impact test, which is the standard of care that you must pass after a concussion before returning to play. So in terms of contributions, as you mentioned, I've written quite a few papers and this and that, but probably the most significant thing is preventing athletes and anybody else from going back into a sport before the brain has completely healed. And we know that people can appear quite normal and answer questions, but when you test them in terms of their ability to process information, their memory, their emotional ability, things could be faked or missed, but you can't fake it on the test we devise. So that's a little bit about concussions, and it's now available for kids down to 6 years of age. So anybody, a parent, what's the most common cause of concussions? Falls. It's not football. Bicycles, skateboards, falling down the steps, things of this nature. And this test is very valuable in assessing recovery.
Do you have to have a baseline assessment in order to get the follow-up?
It's optimal, but not necessarily because of the database we now have in terms of ages and demographics.
And what happens if someone does go back into sport before their brain has been able to recover from a concussion?
Excellent question, Ashley. What happens to the brain in a concussion? There's a loss of autoregulation of the brain, of the blood flow. If I stand up from this chair, I don't pass out because my brain blood vessels squeeze and get more blood to my brain, and I autoregulate my cerebral blood flow. When you have a concussion, you lose autoregulation. And if you get hit again with less force, less impact, it can cause a huge rush of blood into your brain and actually cause what's called the second impact syndrome. And that is hyperperfusion of the brain and also massive cerebral edema. And it can be fatal if they go back too soon. But that's kind of on the rare side, the second impact syndrome. More commonly, with less force, there's more damage that occurs to the brain, which prolongs the recovery very significantly and worsens the underlying damage.
Yeah. And Joe, it sounds like, or it's looked like football players are aging faster and living shorter. Is it real, or is just something that we assume that it's look like, but it's not the reality?
Well, Gil, you're familiar with the paper that was published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine last year, actually. It's entitled Health Span and Chronic Disease Burden Among Young Adult and Middle-Aged Male and Former American-Style Professional Football Players. So this study out of Boston, actually, looked at a large cohort of American-style football players and concluded basically that American-style football players age faster. I will agree with the authors of that paper in terms of arthritis. Yes, because of knee injuries and shoulder injuries, there clearly is more long-term morbidity in those injuries. But they also looked at dementia and heart disease and obesity. And I take great issue with the paper because of there's a huge selection bias in which they took athletes. In fact, they took athletes who were receiving compensation from the National Football League, which amounted to over 15,000 players. They sent questionnaires out to them. They only got a 27% response rate. So one out of four responded. So immediately you have a huge selection bias because the people who responded are probably going to be those who have more problems, more ailments, more physical issues.
Yeah.
So the selection bias there to me is huge and really takes much of what they published, in my opinion, needs further study. Let me put it that way. And the other thing, all of them were self-reported. There were no medical data, no review of charts. You know, they call somebody up, do you have arthritis, such and such? And yeah, of course I have arthritis. Are you demented? Are you having problems with your memory? And yeah, I got problems with my memory. Because if they don't say they do, Gil, they're getting compensated by the National Football League.
Yeah.
You lose their compensation. So the bias in terms of the data is so overwhelming, if nothing else, because of that. You know,
yeah.
I'm receiving a significant payment from the NFL because I'm injured. Am I not going to say I'm having problems?
Yeah. Okay.
And then they commented on obesity by using BMI. And we all know that BMI is an imperfect study, imperfect way of measuring obesity. So, is it an answer to your question in terms of long-term effects? Surely. The pounding that they take in terms of joint problem, are substantial, and I totally concur with that. In terms of heart disease, in terms of dementia, I would take issue with that. They only went up to age 59. They didn't go beyond that. And dementia, clearly, after that is much more significant. So this whole area of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, there's a whole lot of questions that need to be asked about that and the criteria used to make that diagnosis. We started recently at the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Pittsburgh Sports Brain Bank. And it's a little different from other brain banks in that there's the opportunity for peer review of slides by 10 other institutions and neuropathologists who are very experienced in the neuropathology of brain trauma. We believe that peer review is very, very important in this. And this is not always the case in reports that come out about CTE. the peer review is not perhaps optimal, and the transparency in that regard. So, you know, it's an intensely important subject. You know, what's the problem of not the big hit, but subconcussive blows in its relationship to chronic traumatic encephalopathy is a huge, huge debate now. And I'm actually involved with a company called Prevent Biometrics. Prevent Biometrics has devised a mouthpiece with measurement devices, triaxial accelerometers, that now is going to be demanded by all rugby, by national rugby in England, Ireland, Africa. The players wear these, and what it does, are you familiar with the dosimetry badge for X-ray, Gil?
No.
Radiologists and anybody in around X-ray units have to wear a little badge. Badge measures the amount of radiation exposure to each individual whenever you're taking X-ray, CT, angiofluorescence. Yeah. So it's a dosimetry badge. And this is new. Nobody listening to this knows about this. We now have a dosimetry badge for concussions.
Yeah.
This mouthpiece, which is attached to the skull through the jaw, measures the location of the hit, the number of hits, and the G forces of the hit. So we can now, and we know that between 50 and 60 Gs, there's a high likelihood or a reasonable likelihood that this may prove to be a concussive blow. So we also will be able, we are able to measure the cumulative G forces an athlete takes to the head over time. So in the NFL now, they have what's called the eye in the sky. They have a trainer up at the press box watching the game, binoculars, and on three TVs. And a player goes down, gets up slowly. You know, they call down to the sidelines, and Dr. Maroon or Dr. whomever, take a look at number 59. It looks like he got up slowly. He may have a concussion. What now is available, and hopefully will be available soon, you'll have an iPad, and you'll know the G forces of hit for every player on the field and when it occurs. Wow. So the eye in the sky will not only look at the TV booth, but he'll say number 59 just had a hit of G forces of 65 Gs. Take a look at him. So
that's amazing. Yes.
That's where we're going.
Yeah, that's the technology. I have a question, a follow-up question about concussion. So is there any lifestyle intervention that will help to prevent concussions? For example, a kind of a food or a, I don't know, if you sleep better, you have a better chance to get it in less severe way, or nothing more about that?
I don't think any of the lifestyle factors would obviate a concussion, since it really is the mechanical force to the head causing rotational acceleration usually that leads to axonal problems and electrical discharge and either loss of consciousness or problem. However, what you do bring up, and you mentioned Shai Afradi, you know, what can we do for a concussion after it occurs? For quite a few years, I've recommended various supplements, high doses of omega-3 fatty acids, fish oil. Why? Because the membrane of every cell in our brain is very high in DHA, and the cellular membranes get jostled and damaged. I've recommended anti-inflammatories, resveratrol, curcumin, magnesium. All of these supplements I think, are somewhat neuroprotective. But over the last 10 years, Gil, we have the largest concussion clinic in the United States here at UPMC that I and Dr. Freddie Fu, an orthopedic surgeon, started in 2003. We see 7,000 new patients with concussions a year, probably the largest concussion clinic in the country. The great majority of these get better with the various therapies that are used. A small percentage don't. I will see some of these patients who don't get better. And about 8 to 10 years ago, I've been referring them for hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And after 20 or 30 dives, the parents would come back and say, "You've given me my son back. You've given me my daughter back." They couldn't go to school. They had photophobia. They couldn't remember. Their memory was impaired. And that's why I personally went down to the Aviv Clinic in Florida, in the Villages, and spent 3 months doing 60 dives, 5 days a week, 2 hours a dive, myself, with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Beforehand, I had cardiopulmonary fitness tests, including VO2 max and anaerobic threshold measured. I had a brain scan, my MRI, tractography, my cerebral blood flow with MR, BOLD, and also SPECT scanning. And I had neurocognitive testing of an hour and a half, measure my own brain speed, memory, and recall. I did this before and I did it after. And I published this in a paper in Progress in Neurology, actually Frontiers in Neurology, about a year ago, and entitled The Difference Between Zero and One. And Bill Sweet, who was the head of neurosurgery at the Mass General quite a few years ago and a good friend, said, optimally, double-blind, randomized study, placebo-controlled are the best. But if you have very good data and a trial, just like I think I did, including proteinomics, which I measure, you could derive significant amount of information from one. So his title of his paper was The Difference Between Zero and One. And I parlayed that or stole it, I guess you could say, for the title of my own paper. And then Shai Afradi and I and Amir Hadani, who's another just absolutely brilliant neurosurgeon from Israel, published a paper recently reviewing the literature on traumatic brain injury and hyperbaric oxygen therapy, showing that, again, there's an absolute definite role for HBO in traumatic brain injury. So I think it's terribly underused. Most people don't know about it, including most neurologists. It's for stroke. If I had a stroke, there's no question that I'd be in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber as soon as I could. Spinal cord injury, the same. But again, I'm, you know, when I talk about this, the medical groups, they wonder what I'm smoking. you know, what happened to Maroon? Where did he get off the wagon? But I'm convinced that at my time in life, I can take the criticism.
As a Longevity by Design podcast listener, you understand the value of improving your health for today and for all the years ahead. And if you want to live your healthiest, longest life possible, you need to understand what's going on inside. At Inside Tracker, we take a personalized approach to health span optimization that eliminates guesswork from your wellness plan. Inside Tracker analyzes blood biomarker and DNA data, along with physiomarker data from fitness trackers like Oura Ring, to deliver personalized food, supplement, lifestyle, and exercise recommendations that allow you to take control and improve your health span. And for a limited time, Longevity by Design listeners can get 20% off at the Inside Tracker store. So if you're ready to receive a personal health analysis and data-driven wellness plan to optimize your body for the long haul, then it's time to start inside. Visit insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today. That's insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today.
Yeah, so And another part of your life, as we discussed before, is being a triathlete and have been in many races of triathlon. Can you describe, in your opinion, how being a triathlete helped you in becoming healthier, improve performance, and most importantly, longevity?
Gail, triathlons literally saved my life. Literally. And when I was about 44, my father died at age 60 of a heart attack. My family broke up for reasons that were okay, weren't okay at all, but it happened. And I had to quit neurosurgery. And my father bequeathed to my mother an old, dirty, dilapidated truck stop in Wheeling, West Virginia. And I, because of stress, because of major depression, I could no longer operate. I was doing awake brain surgery on patients at the University of Pittsburgh Hospital, and chief of the medical service, the neurosurgical service, one day. All that happened in 1 week, and I couldn't handle it, and I moved to Wheeling, West Virginia on a farm, and I literally worked in this truck stop flipping hamburgers and filling up 18-wheelers for a year. After about 4 months of autonomous, just zombie-like living, the banker who held the mortgage on the truck stop called me one day and said, "Joe, you need to go for a run." I said, "Run? I'm 20 pounds overweight. I can't walk up a flight of steps without being short of breath. Come on." So I found a pair of scrubs and a pair of sneakers. We went down to the local high school track, and I made it around four times, Gil. Exhausted. Couldn't walk. And short of breath. I said, "Never again." That night, though, was the first night I slept in about 4 months. The next day I went back and I did a mile and a quarter. Then I did a mile and a half. Then I did two. Then I did three. As the unintended side effect of running, my depression started to lift. Pounds started to come off. I made better choices in my diet. I picked up a Bible that was quite dusty after many years, and got back to a spiritual basis. I reconnected with my family and friends. And after a year, I was able to get back to the University of Pittsburgh, and actually the most productive time of my career up till today. So when I say triathlon saved my life, after running, I learned to swim. And I got a bike to cross train, and I entered into a very small triathlon, 300 meter swim, 10 mile bike and 5K run. I felt like Roger Bannister breaking the 4 minute mile when I finished that. And each year I kept raising the bar until I got accepted into the Hawaiian Ironman by a lottery. And that's a 2.4 mile ocean swim, 112 mile bike, in a marathon, all the same day. And I subsequently have done 8 Ironman distance races, 5 in Hawaii, and which is the world championship. And I say that not to boast, although when you do that,
hard,
you're allowed to.
Yeah.
But the message is, what I was doing by running around that track who wrote Man's Search for Reason, Gil? Man's Search for Reason. The Auschwitz, he was in, why can't I remember his name? Viktor Frankl. He wrote a book, Man's Search for Reason, and he said, happiness occurs as the unintended side effect of doing what is the right thing in your life. So as the unintended side effect of that activity, I was rebooting my neurotransmitters. I was elevating my serotonin without SSRIs. I was increasing my dopamine and stimulating my nucleus accumbens without drugs. I was enhancing my endorphins and my endocannabinoid system without THC. And finding that the five pillars that I mentioned earlier, that exercise, diet, avoiding environmental toxins, controlling stress, which is a huge stress controller. What's the best antidepressant? Actually, what's the best antidepressant?
Exercise. Yeah.
Physical exercise. there have been many studies comparing SSRIs, psychotropic drugs, and exercise for patients who are depressed. And it clearly is the best. No side effects, no decreased libido, no nausea, sleep, and all that stuff. So it's doing the right thing, and the unintended side effect is a healthier, more productive life. And I mentioned my father died at age 60 of a heart attack, an MI. So I'm the same gene, same physiology, same body habitus, but his diet, he didn't exercise. His sleep habits were poor. His toxins were there as well. And it's epigenetic, just like David Sinclair, you know, has pioneered with the world his work with epigenetics and modulating genes.
Yeah, and by the way, I met with David a week ago in the aging conferences in Europe, and David introduced between us. So I know that you and David are very close. And
tell him I want to be like him when I grow up.
I have a question, a follow-up question on something that you said earlier about oxidative stress is something we are free radicals, let's say, more commonly is a term people would know, something we all are creating, in particular when we're making ATP. So for athletes, we, in theory, or athletes would have a higher production of these free radicals. And you were saying that, you know, leading to some conditions, neurological conditions that they would have potentially or could cause them. So outside of just concussions, is there a link between a greater production of free radicals from energy production that could potentially lead to some of those types of neurological conditions?
That's an excellent question, Ashley. As you know, everything is about homeostasis and about balance. Free radicals actually are a positive influence in terms of infections. I mean, if you get an infection, free radicals are released and they're destructive to the bacteria or even viruses that occur. But we're constantly modulating our free radicals and our oxidative stress with antioxidants. So that's where our diet needs to come in. You need the vegetables, the fruits, the berries, the nuts, the fiber, the good products to counter the production of the free radicals. And you need rest. So all of those things are very, very important in a balance. Life is about balance. And if you overstress yourself with exercise, you get more injuries. It can affect your mood, your brain. You know, I've been training for triathlons. It's 18 to 20 hours a week in a time, and also a full-time job doing your day job. And rest becomes incredibly important. So what happens when we sleep? What happens to the brain when we sleep? Well, you're familiar with the glymphatic system. The glymphatic system is like the lymphatic system of the body, the glymphatic system in the brain. It's the removal of the waste products that occur from oxidation and energy production in the brain, and also the clearing of beta amyloid. You know that the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease are the deposition of beta amyloid plaque and neurofibrillary tangles. And billions of dollars are spent and have been spent and continuing to be spent by drug companies on the beta amyloid hypothesis. Lecumbent, the recent drug that was just released that cost $26,000, only reduces dementia in 27% of patients and has a 21% complication rate of intracranial hemorrhages and cerebral edema, was just approved by the FDA for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And what does it do? Well, it reduces the beta amyloid plaque, which the hypothesis is that's the genesis of the Alzheimer's disease. I don't think it is. I think the beta amyloid plaque comes from the oxidative stress, the mitochondrial destruction and problems, and subsequently. So what happens when we sleep, our glymphatic system drains the beta amyloid plaque that does accumulate in our brains. So sleep is a preventive mechanism for Alzheimer's disease and mood and many other things, obviously.
It's a great plug for not burning the candle at both ends, so to speak. It's excellent to wake up and exercise, but if it's cutting into the amount of sleep that you're able to get.
Correct.
Certain points, again, balance, not always making sense. Last question that we have in a diet section is keto, since it's so popular right now. The keto diet was created for patients with epilepsy, but there's a lot of information about patients that maybe have cancer or certain types of brain cancer. So just a question on if the keto diet is something that you're aware of improving certain outcome in patients perhaps that you operate on that have tumors.
You're asking brain. All the good questions, Ashley. Thomas Seyfried, I don't know if you know of Thomas, he's at Boston College. He's an absolute brilliant investigator who wrote a book, The Metabolic Basis of Cancer. And the thesis or hypothesis is that cancer is a metabolic disease. And again, it's due to mitochondrial damage and subsequent problems with mitosis, underlying genetic problems as well, and cancer develop. So what do we mean by the ketogenic diet? When we were on the savanna in Africa and it was feast or famine, we would gourmandize on whatever we would kill and build up body fat for times of famine. And when famine occurred, our body fat would be more mobilized and broken down into ketone bodies. And we can survive for the most part on ketone bodies for a significant period of time. Now, if you consider cancer a new development in an old body, evolutionary, biologically, cancers are completely dependent on glucose for metabolism. So when we do a PET scan, what are we looking at? We're looking at the uptake of a PET scan to see if we have cancer in our bodies or residual cancer. The tumors will take up the glucose, it'll light up on a screen, and that's a positive PET scan showing cancer. So basically what we're doing with a ketogenic diet is starving the cancer by not providing any glucose. A ketogenic diet is based on less than 50 grams of carbohydrate a day. That's tough, but it's less than 50 grams. So you're literally removing the sugar substrate for cancer to survive. But the body is now breaking down fat or using ingested fat for survival and a healthy survival for the most part. Not only is the ketogenic diet, I think, should be mandatory in patients with cancer, given certain parameters and frailty and all those things, the patient can tolerate it. And I think it should definitely be incorporated with any chemotherapeutic or radiation therapy. It's an adjunct. And for neurodegenerative disease as well, there's a place for it in, I think, Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, the ketogenic diet. So I think it's a powerful tool in cancer management. And we've actually reported on some cases, particularly a couple of brain tumor patients who have survived way beyond the normal expectation, who were very vigilant about a ketogenic diet. So again, it was like talking about hyperbaric oxygen therapy to neurologists and stroke. You know, what? Don't tell me about that. Now, I started talking about this 8 or 10 years ago with Tom Seyfried. And I said, why doesn't everybody do this? It's only now, even our neuro-oncologists here at UPMC at Pittsburgh are incorporating this into their regimen for cancer treatment of brain tumors. So William Osler, a very famous physician who started the medical program at Johns Hopkins in the late 1800s, cautioned physicians to be neither the first to accept change nor the last. And, you know, and I go along with that. There's a lot of charlatans. There's a lot of things, particularly in your field, Ashley, with dietetics, you know, things that are cure-alls and this and that. So you have to be circumspect, cautious. But, I mean, the things we're talking about, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, ketogenic diet, and the other things are all, I think, beyond their time for being instituted.
So how can someone that has cancer convince his clinician to go into or to start a ketogenic diet? What is the best way to communicate it with the clinician?
That's an excellent question. I mean, if you Google ketogenic diet and cancer, you'll come up with an awful lot of papers. And there's a book, Keto for Cancer, by Miriam Kalamian, Kalamian, who's a dietitian. Brilliant individual who wrote a beautiful layman's book with instructions on how to institute the ketogenic diet by oneself. But that plus the papers of Thomas Seyfried. I mean, he's published, he's lectured at international conferences. He's The Metabolic Basis of Cancer is a classic textbook that explains the whys and everything about it. You know, go to the papers. I mean, the scientific papers are there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that there is more and more evidence about a ketogenic diet and the cancer. And as you said, the clinicians are usually slow to adopt a new method, especially if it's a lifestyle. It's something that they, look at it inferior to, operation or other intervention. So definitely it's something that it will be good for some of the clinicians to be educated on. And we would like actually to switch gears and discuss something that is very close to my heart. And we are seeing more and more evidence about how important it is and that VO2 max, and I'm sure you, Joe, as a triathlete and as someone that educated scientist, I would say, know a lot about it. So can you explain to our audience what is VO2 max and how VO2 max related to cardiovascular fitness, and what are the benefits maybe of a higher VO2 max to health, wellness, and longevity?
So the VO2 max is the maximum amount of oxygen that you can absorb and use during exercise. So it's typically done in on a stress test thing. So you're breathing a mask of oxygen and measuring the volume of oxygen that you consume and burn over a given period of time, per minute usually. And what that is assessing, of course. So when you're talking about inhaling oxygen, what you're doing is it's going into your bronchial tubes and then into your alveoli. And then it's assuming your alveoli, well, assuming nothing, they either healthy or unhealthy or not as healthy as they should be, so that the oxygen can permeate the alveolar wall, get into the microvascular circulation, be picked up by hemoglobin, taken to your body where oxygen plus glucose goes into the Krebs cycle, and you make ATP in the mitochondria. So the measure of the VO2 max in athletes, you know, a healthy 20 to 25, 29-year-old will be able to do 55 ml per minute over a certain period of time. Somebody my age would be probably in the range of 42 would be very good. Less than 25 would be bad. So it's a measure of your oxygenation. How much under exercise, under physical activity, how much oxygen you can get into your blood and into your cells and make ATP. So it is a measure of fitness, and it's also correlated with dying. As your VO2 max goes down, your level of activity goes down, your functional capacity goes down, and eventually can't go down any further. So it's essential. It's a very good biomarker of fitness. And the question is, so how do we maintain our VO2 max? How do we enhance our ability to use oxygen? And it goes back to no pain, no gain. In the sense of high intensity interval training is probably the optimal way to push yourself to do wind sprints or to walk as fast as you can or take the steps, not the elevator. You know, whatever you can do to push your body, I guess the term is hormesis. You know, you have to stress the body. Hans Selye, the physiologist, the Canadian physiologist who really did so much work on stress and wrote about the adaptation syndrome. And he talked about eustress, EU, meaning good stress, and distress, DIS, meaning bad stress. So if you draw a chart and a curve, eustress gets up to an apogee, and then anymore, it becomes distress. We need stress to become better, stronger, faster, higher. Mm-hmm. It's being, like the Buddhists say, mindful and aware of when the eustress, good stress, becomes distress and becomes a form of burnout and overexhausted, overcommitted, overwhelmed. And then, as Selye talked about, the adaptation syndrome, with any stress, there's initial resistance. Then there's resilience. Then after resilience, there's exhaustion. And then there's death in terms of animals putting into stressful environments. And it's the same with people.
Yeah. So we have a high number of users in InstaTracker. We are close to 100,000 users. And a lot of them have been tested for VO2 max as well. So we started to have a correlation. Again, it's unpublished yet. We are working on writing a manuscript about it. But what we have tried to do is to build a correlation matrix between VO2 max and the other blood biomarkers, and we are testing around 50. And what we have seen was amazing, that actually VO2 max is positively correlated with markers such as HDL and testosterone and iron levels. So basically, higher VO2 max, higher HDL, which is the good cholesterol, higher testosterone, higher iron, but negatively correlated with other markers such as ApoB, which is, as we know, it's better to have a lower ApoB, LDL, triglyceride, glucose, A1C, hsCRP, and so on. So basically, we see a VO2 max as a master health span biomarker. When you have a higher VO2 max, as you said, you have a much better chance to have a better cardiovascular health, but also a lot of other blood biomarkers that resemble of health. We took it one step further and we look at, what happened for a subpopulation that tested with a VO2 max that was X and then increased the VO2 max in the follow-up test. And we've seen a correlation, again, it's just correlation, with improvement of blood biomarkers as well. So basically, improvement of the VO2 max will improve your blood biomarkers, which is amazing. So I tend to agree to what you are saying, that VO2 max is a really master regulator of health span and our audience should take it seriously and try to improve the VO2 max as much as they can.
Fantastic. How many patients have you measured this on?
So we have, I don't have the exact number, but for VO2 max, we have around 10,000.
10,000?
Yeah. And we are using, it's not the test that you mentioned that I've done, hopping on a treadmill and having the mask. It's more like an estimation of the VO2 max based on a fitness tracker, which is not as accurate, but it's still giving you estimation of what is your VO2 max today. A fitness tracker such as Apple Watch and the Garmin provide the estimation of VO2 max. So, because it's very hard to do the test that you mentioned, we are using something that is more available for the population. But again, I was amazed by the result, and we just got it a few weeks ago. We are really excited about it. So, absolutely, VO2 max is a very important marker.
Is there any relation that you know between VO2 max scores and someone maintaining cognitive function better as they age?
Well,
wonder maybe it's a proxy measure, or is there a mechanism?
I don't have specific information, but just intuitively, if your VO2 max is elevated, you're going to be better oxygenating your brain. You're probably going to be making vascular endothelial growth factor, which enhances new vessel formation, not only in your alveoli, but possibly also in the brain. So just intuitively, I would think that by increasing your VO2 max, you're going to be enhancing your cognitive ability as well.
Yeah.
This makes sense.
I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%. It should improve cognition as well. And we see it with some of the markers that we are looking at.
Yeah, very interesting study to looking into older athletes measuring their VO2 max compared to other individuals of their same age, and also, combining that with some cognitive tests. I don't know, maybe it's there.
Yeah.
Gil, do you want to mention the figure from Pilatia's book?
Yeah, sure. So I know that a lot of our audience read the book from Peter Attia that he published a couple of months ago. I don't know if you have read this book, Joe?
Attila?
Peter Attia?
Peter
Attia?
No, yeah. I've read excerpts from it. I've listened to some of his podcasts. I know some of the things that I'm, you know, what he's doing and about aging and the VO2 max that he talks about, as you did, a very good biomarker.
Yeah. So basically what he, in the, one of the figures that he's showing in the, in his book is basically the relationship, what you mentioned about how VO2 max is decreasing with age, which we well know, it's well known and published, but also how a higher VO2 max is have a correlation with a better performance. So, for example, and you mentioned it when we started to discuss VO2 max, you said someone in his 20s might have a VO2 max of around 50, and someone that is 80s, usually, if he's very good, he will have maybe a VO2 max of 40. And there is a strong correlation between a higher VO2 max and running at a speed of, I don't know, 10 miles an hour, or a very low VO2 max, and you barely can walk, and it's up to you, for you even to move. So, again, it's a nice figure that I will strongly recommend to everyone that interested in the longevity to look at the book of Peter Attia. But again, it's summarized very well what we discussed in the last few minutes about a VO2 max and how important it is. And I think that we are, unfortunately, we have a lot of other questions, but we are running out of time. And we usually, at the end of the discussion, we are asking our guests, tell us, what is, if you had one recommendation to provide to our guests, what is the best intervention that they can do in order to live better, longer? And in your example, maybe about what is the best advice to improve your cognition when you are getting older? What is the best advice that you can give to our audience?
Well, Gil, you know, I wrote a book entitled Square One, A Simple Guide to a Balanced Life. And we spoke earlier about balance and homeostasis. And I think the best advice that I would have for the audience is outlined in the book in terms of a simple nomogram of sorts to lead a balanced life, to attain homeostasis and balance, enhance cognition, enhance performance. And what I want the audience to do listening is to draw a square. On the top, put work. On this side, put family and social. On the bottom, put spiritual, and on this side, put physical. Now, I want you to draw a line commensurate with how much effort you put on each of these on a daily basis. How long is your work line? How long is your family line? How long is your spiritual line? And how long is your physical? When I burned out, so to speak, had to leave neurosurgery, my line was all work. There was no family, there was no spiritual, and there was no physical. It's about balance. It's about balancing those four entities: work, family, and social, spiritual, and physical. You can get by without one of them, or one of them being atrophic. If two of them are atrophic, you're probably seeing your rabbi, your minister, your priest, your psychiatrist. And you really need to be, as I mentioned earlier, like the Buddha say, you have to be mindful and aware. Each day when I get in my car, I look at my tachometer. And when you look at your tachometer, you have a red zone. That's when your engine's overheated. You must be able to look at your own life, your own activity level, and determine what's my anxiety level, what's my depression level, Am I in the red zone with my work? If you are, and you stay in the red zone, you're going to overheat your engine and you're going to burn out. So it's, again, aware, cognitive, mindfulness, and thinking of those four things. If they're in balance, you're going to enhance your longevity. You're going to enhance your mental performance. You're going to enhance your physical performance as best as you can, barring being hit by a bus or something like that, you know, the accidents that occur to all of us. So anyway, that would be my suggestion. Square one, a simple guide to a balanced life. And that's the simple guide.
Excellent. That was a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Joe, for the amazing discussion and all the great advice that you supply to us and our audience. I really appreciate your support in the last 10 years or so of InstaTracker, and hopefully we'll continue to work together for a very long time, and invite you to another interview in a few years and discuss the follow-up.
Well, thank you.
Again, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
My great pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit InsideTracker.com/podcasts.